British Prime Minister Boris Johnson on Monday ruled out ever asking the European Union to delay Brexit, making an implicit warning that he would be forced to call a general election if his hands were tied by Parliament. An alliance of opposition lawmakers and rebels from within Johnson's own Conservatives are seeking to take control of Parliament in order to pass legislation that would force Johnson to seek a three-month delay to prevent a no-deal Brexit.
Argentina's central bank is now centre stage in the country's deepening economic crisis. Over the weekend, the government gave it authority to restrict the purchase of dollars. Businesses will now need permission to purchase foreign currency and make transfers abroad. The move comes as the country burns through foreign exchange reserves. Since Wednesday, the central bank has spent about $1 billion in an effort to prop up the Argentine peso.
As a boxer, Manny Pacquiao is used to the limelight. But on stage with his wife in Manila on Sunday, the 40-year-old launched his very own cryptocurrency. Pacquiao, who is also a Philippine senator, hopes to cash in on his PAC tokens, which will allow fans to buy his merchandise and interact with him on social media. It is the world's first celebrity cryptocurrency. The PAC token will be listed on Singapore's global crypto offering exchange.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Tuesday. It's September 3rd, and it's 5:09 in the morning. Thank you for tuning in and waking up with us on The Opening Bell this morning. It's another business week getting underway after a three-day holiday in the markets and in business. Lots to get to today. We'll update the numbers, how things fared over the last few days in business. There were a couple of things happening around the world that we'll update you on as well, including potential of China-U.S. trade talks coming, all of that impacting the markets today. On the program today here on The Opening Bell, a couple of cool authors with great stories to tell. First up this morning, Josh Levine, principal of Great Mondays, co-founder of Culture LabX, and author of a new book called Great Mondays, How to Design a Company Culture Employees Love. We'll talk to Josh about why it is important to not only foster this to develop it, but also to foster a great culture. It could impact everything from hiring to employee retention to the bottom line as well. That'll be first up this morning. A little bit later on, have you always wondered what might be the end of the world? What might cause it? Brian Walsh, a science journalist and author of End Times, A Brief Guide to the End of the World, will be with us. Brian has been reporting on a lot of this stuff most of his adult career, and he will tell us about some of the threats that he is most concerned about. That'll be at about 5:38 this morning. But first, let's begin on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. The markets reopened today after taking that break for the Labor Day holiday weekend, a mixed trading day on Friday, and some weakness this morning in the markets. Dow futures are off nearly 250 points, nearly a percent this morning, nearly a percent on S&P futures, more than a percent on NASDAQ futures, down 91 points this morning. Again, concern about U.S.-China trade is fueling this. Tariffs went into effect over the weekend, new tariffs on China, which means you'll be paying more for a lot of items. We'll get to some of that momentarily this morning. In Europe, markets are in the red as well. The FTSE off nearly a quarter of a percent, down 21 points. In Germany, off nearly 66 points. The DAX down nearly a half a percent. In France, off nearly a half a percent as well. In Asia, markets are mixed this morning with numbers coming out of Hong Kong lower, out of China a little bit higher, and Tokyo a little bit higher as well. And oil in the United States is at $54.31 a barrel, which is down about 79 cents. As we begin this morning, a couple of stories. First, the futures market, the stocks reacting to the potential of trade talks being delayed even further. 250 points lower, as I mentioned this morning. New U.S.-China trade tariffs took effect over the weekend, and 15% tariffs on a variety of goods. A lot of them will impact you probably for the first time, including technology and shoes. There has been some dates floating around for a potential meeting with the Chinese, but nothing has been set in stone yet. And a new report says that China growing a little bit more wary of the United States after these new tariffs took effect. They were hoping for a little bit more trust. and a little bit more from the United States in order to set some of these talks. Also this morning in the Europe, in Great Britain, the sterling has fallen below $1.20, hitting its lowest level since October 2016. There was a flash crash back then. Over the weekend, the British Prime Minister talked about having another election. There are concerns about a no-deal Brexit. Also, more Kmart and Sears stores will be closing. Nearly 100 locations will close by mid-December or sooner. This comes after the two retailers' parent company announced that 26 stores would close in late October. The company hasn't released an official list of the latest stores that are closing. Liquidation sales are expected to begin later this month. And let's begin front and center this morning with Josh Levine, principal of Great Mondays, co-founder of Culture LabX, and author of Great Mondays, How to Design a Company Culture That Employees Love. This notion of company culture could impact the bottom line, could impact a company's ability to find, keep, and even support the best employees. Josh, good morning. Welcome to the Opening Bell.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This book, Great Mondays, I'm guessing the title means having a company culture where you're excited and happy to come to work on Monday every week.
That's right. As absurd as it sounds, that's what I believe we can actually make happen.
There are lots of conversations happening about company culture, what makes a good company culture, how do you maintain one. What are your thoughts on this? How important is a company culture to the success of any enterprise?
Well, obviously, since I wrote a book on it, I believe it's very, very important. In our sort of modern era where business is moving so fast, competitors are popping up overnight, and we have to do all these, like, turn on a dime kind of maneuvers. Culture is the way that we're actually going to empower employees to make better decisions more quickly. And so that's why I introduce a framework for understanding it, because often people think, oh, it's ping pong and pizza, which is, you know, that's part of it. You know, definitely want to have those nice casual times. But it is it really, I believe it's a rigorous business tool that we can actually use to improve the bottom line and the work-life experience of all of our employees.
Yeah, the bottom line is something I'd like to ask you about. I mean, if we could put a dollars and cents on it, has that been done yet? I mean, does a company with a good culture do extraordinarily better than another company that doesn't have culture? And what kind of studies and information do we have about that bottom line?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are a number of studies out there. There's no sort of one number, but let me give you an example. Typically, when we think about an organization that has a good company culture, they're going to have a lower rate of turnover, right? So your employees are going to stay longer. And the average cost of replacing an employee, don't even consider the amount of time it takes to find and onboarding them, is about 100%, if not more, of their salary. So if you can create a culture where people actually want to stay, then you're immediately, that's the first thing, right? Like, that's like an easy number to go to, right? So if you have an executive who's, you know, let's say making $200,000 a year, and they sign on, and then, and I heard this just recently, and then 3 months later, this was actually a real thing, 3 months later, they said, oh, that was not what I was expecting, and that was not where I wanted to go to work, so that I'm going to leave. So then you're going to spend another $200,000 at least finding that next VP to step up, and that's the case if you think about multiplying that over, you know, all the workers. So that's one of the measures, and then there's a couple others, right? So it's speed to productivity. So how quickly do you get them ramped up? How long do they stay? How much are they engaged? So that means how hard are they working? But when we talk about engagement, I heard this definition that's like employee engagement is how much time, how much effort over the bare minimum are you putting in? So that's another one. Those are the kind of data points that you're going to look at. So if you calculate it for your own business, that's where you start to see being able to figure out kind of some of those numbers.
Yeah, and people have even gone in and they've looked at, let's say, Fortune 500 companies, and we have all these great studies and surveys about what it's like to work and are these good places to work. they've compared those surveys with how well the company does, how well the bottom line, you know, it's quarterly reports. And it does show that the companies that have good culture are making money as well.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's right. And but it. So the question is, right, it's like correlation does not equal causation, but it almost doesn't matter if you have great leadership. And it is the reason why you both have a better, you know, more improved bottom line and a better culture. That's, you know, that's where we need to really pay attention and say, okay, look, these are the kinds of organizations that I want to work for. I want to work for a successful company. I want to work for someone, for a leader who understands that working with folks is in creating an environment that is actually going to help me do my best work. Is really where I want to spend my time.
So a lot of the questions are not just about does this culture exist? Is it good? Is it bad? But how do you create the culture, the good culture in the first place? And that's where your book comes in, Great Mondays. It's a real framework for coming up with the ways to create this culture. Talk to us a little bit about what you've done in the book to help people find that.
Right. So as I mentioned before, culture is often thought of as a fuzzy topic. But what I wanted to do was demonstrate that we can put some edges around this and actually understand how to design and manage for our culture. So in the book, I have six components that I put forth that describe kind of a system that helps leaders and managers at all levels understand how to actually start implementing a better culture. So the six components, we've got the first three are purpose, values, and behaviors. Purpose is your North Star. Values are your guardrails. Purpose is your why. Values are your how. And behaviors are really the output. That's why we talk about culture. The center point of culture is the decisions that we make. So those are the first three. And when you think about creating a vision or deciding what kind of culture do I want? And then the second three, recognition, rituals, and cues, are how we activate or operationalize the culture itself. Because just because you put values up on the wall doesn't mean people are going to start behaving that way. We need to have aligned incentives. So recognition in the book, there's a number of different ways or categories of recognition. And it's not a new idea, of course. Rewards and recognition are a very old trick. The problem is most organizations do not recognize the right thing and they don't do it the right way. So we need to get aligned with what we're trying to create. Rituals are kind of those are the recurring activities that strengthen the synapses of culture. And the synapses of culture, those are relationships. So as an organization grows, you get these barriers that are kind of erected, both literal and metaphorical barriers. And people, the little groups start to form. And that's when you get those silos that people are always talking about. Hey, we've got silos. We need to break out of our silos. So rituals are how we actually build and strengthen relationships across those silos so that the behaviors that we talked about before can be contagious, the ones that we want, so that if we don't have that, then you're going to get those maybe mini cultures that may or may not be what you want. And then finally, the sixth component are cues. So cues are physical and behavioral reminders of what we're doing here. So every business, no matter how amazing the culture is, every business, you got to do a new email and you got to do the end of the quarter reports and the budgets and client presentations or whatever it might be, right? Like that's just all part and parcel of the business, no matter what business you're in. So what we want to do as leaders is be able to remind people, what are we doing here at work? Why are we getting together, and what is it we're trying to achieve together? And they can be short or long-term goals, but ultimately what happens is those cues link us right back to the top, to the first and second component of culture, purpose, and values, and that's how it becomes an upward spiral of improved culture inside of your organization.
I like the focus on finding the best people in your organization to sort of not necessarily be the cheerleaders for this, but to be sort of the ringleaders, as it were. You find the people that define your values and purposes in a way and behaviors that other people can follow them. How important is having that team of people in place to do that?
Yeah, it is critical. And this is something I've discovered over a decade of doing this kind of work. What we call those people that you're talking about, culture all-stars. And what those people are the implicit leaders inside the organization. So often we'll go and I'll talk to a client and they say, okay, what are our values? I'm going to tell you what I think is important, you know, the CEO or the VP of, IT or whatever it might be. I want to tell you what I think. And the truth is that it's not the executive team that's going to define the values true sort of self. We got to find the people inside the organization that are already doing the amazing work. We don't invent anything when we come in and work with clients. And so we say, who are the people that if you could replicate would create this incredible workforce over the next 10 years? And they go, oh, I know who that is. It's Sanjay and it's Mary and it's Susan, right? Like they know exactly who you're talking about. Those people already have a following and built trust inside the organization. So there's two reasons that to find those people and work with those people are important. One is that they are already living the culture that you want to create. And so you just tap into them and you say, what is it that's happening here? They have a beat on everything and they know exactly what's going on, even better than the executive team. Number two is when you go through this process, they are already bought in. They're already going to be cheerleaders, as you said. There are going to be people who believe in this idea, and they're going to be the ones. It's not going to be handed down from on high. Okay, everybody, we're going to change our culture now. Like the CEO might say, and everybody goes, huh, what? If you have this, cadre of all-stars, they're across the organization, and people are already following, and they just have to go, hey, everybody, we're doing this now. And everybody goes, right, of course. And that makes a lot of sense. So that is something that the finding the culture all-stars, like if there is one thing, like one tool, one idea that anybody needs to take away from the book or from just listening to this interview, it's the idea of identifying those culture all-stars. That's going to be the key to amplifying the great culture that you already have.
What are the challenges to maintaining the culture once you develop it?
Well, the challenges are the people, the humans is the problem. We are creatures of habit, and we have things we have to do, and we feel very pressured and stressed, or to get things done. And as we mentioned, business is moving faster and faster, so we tend to, as humans, want to go back and do the things the way that we want to do them. And the way we have done them. So what are the habits that we need to shift inside the organization? And that's why we talked about earlier about rewards and recognition, because that's the lever that we're going to need to insert to say, this is what we're rewarding. This is what is going to be successful here. Otherwise, if you don't have that public recognition of the ideal behaviors, the choices where you say, hey, this person is doing this incredible thing and it aligns with our values. This is what we're looking for. Everybody else goes, oh, okay, great. That's what we're talking about. If you're not consistent and persistent when it comes to elevating those values-driven behaviors, people are just going to go back to doing the work the way that they've always done it, and just kind of, and maybe it's okay, but it's not going to be aligned across the board. So that's why this is really hard work. That's why we haven't conquered this yet in business, is because people are, are complex, difficult creatures, and we need to create a system that actually supports them in that way. Now, the good news is once we do create new habits and get everybody moving in the right direction, anybody who comes on board, right, is a new hire or transferred over from another department, immediately go, oh, this is how we do things. And boom, they're onboarded quickly. They know exactly how to get things done, and they know what success looks like. And that's the great, powerful thing about culture.
How commonplace has it become, or is it becoming, to have a chief culture officer at your workplace?
My fingers, all my fingers and toes are crossed. I think this is going to be a role that we're going to see emerging over the next 5 to 10 years. Culture is not something that you can just do off the side of your desk. In the best cases here, I'm talking to you from the Bay Area and Silicon Valley, and here, the best case scenario is someone is in charge of HR and culture. And while those two functions might seem to be aligned or next to each other, culture is too big of a job for any one person to have, and for any person to do off the side of their desk. And so what we want is for a single person to own that function. It is the critical business advantage that every organization is going to need to conquer and learn how to design and manage. And so if you're going to really take this seriously as a business tool, if you're really serious about it, a chief culture officer is going to be critical to getting this right. It is not a job that is, it's not, this is, I kind of joke where it's like, you'd never hear the CFO come in and say, okay, everybody, this quarter we're gonna focus on finance, and then once we get that done, we'll move on to something else, right? It's not like that. I feel like that's how culture is treated. Okay, everybody, this is a half year, we're gonna focus on culture, and then we're moving on to something else. That's not what it is. It needs to be ongoing. It needs to be consistent. And it needs to be someone's in charge of this. It's not. You can't just solve for culture. It's an evolution, and you need someone. You need a leader to actually be able to say, look, this is what we're trying to do. This is the part and parcel of, you know, how we're going to run this business and how it's going to be successful in the future.
Yeah, you know, you look at the trends that will change over the next 5 or 10 years. You mentioned this chief culture officer becoming one of those trends. How company culture is going to be one of the critical pieces of advantage that a company has in the world of competition, right? I mean, this is going to be more so than having a leg up in one field or another. This culture is going to be important about whether or not you're competing and doing well.
Yeah, that's right. When we look at the speed, again, the speed of what, you know, new customers coming on or wanting something different, new competitors, industries, whatever it might be, it's almost as if your product, you know, let's say you have this incredible product, it's got to move, change, and your organization has to be great at shifting. And if you're looking to try to, you know, force everybody to innovate harder or faster or change more, and you're just going to do that by mandate, it's not going to work. And micromanagement is not the solution. You need to be a macro manager. And the framework for culture, the six components, are empowering people and organizations to be able to make better decisions independently, have that autonomy, so that even if another competitor comes out with a product that leapfrogs yours, you're not going to waste your time on trying to, you know, sue them because of your IP or whatever it might be. You're saying, okay, great, what is the next shift that we need to make? And everybody understands the rules of the game. I know the purpose. I know why we're here. I know our values, how we're going to get there. Here's the decisions that we're going to make. And that's how businesses in the future are going to be able to move away from this command and control traditional machine era management style to more of an autonomous, community-oriented, self-organizing kind of business. Culture is the platform on which that's going to happen.
Well, Josh, we appreciate you coming on with us this morning. Here's to a lot of great Mondays ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Josh Levine is author of Great Mondays, How to Design a Company Culture Employees Love. You can find out more about the book and also see a culture design toolkit as well at greatmondays.com. That's greatmondays.com.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Tuesday edition of The Opening Bell. Glad to be back out at it after a long holiday weekend. Let's turn the focus now to perhaps the end of the world. I know it's not the best of topics to begin your work week on, but an interesting topic that is the focus of a new book. And it focuses in on the potential threats to humanity, including asteroids, artificial intelligence, volcanic super eruptions, and bioengineered viruses. Brian Walsh is the author of End Times, A Brief Guide to the End of the World, where he details the probability of some of these earth-ending catastrophes, how they might happen, how they would impact our lives, and the best strategies for saving ourselves. Brian is a foreign correspondent, reporter, and editor for Time. He also writes for Bloomberg, Newsweek, and Medium on sustainability issues. And he is with us this morning on the telephone. Brian, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell.
It's great to be here.
This book, it's called End Times, A Brief Guide to the End of the World. Let's talk about a little bit why you decided to write about this. I know you have a history of reporting on things like SARS and climate change. It seemed like a natural for you?
Yeah, it really was. I mean, I had been a reporter for a number of years, more than a decade, you know, and I had reported on infectious disease pandemics. I spent a lot of time working on climate change, and I've written about sort of global politics, and I realized, you know, all those issues were kind of moving towards this big subject. They're all about the global threats that could affect all of us on this planet. And when I was looking for, you know, a big project to work on after I left Time magazine, this just seemed like a logical one. And then I began to really delve into it, and I found, you know, there are both natural threats that have always been with us, you know, things like asteroids, but really concerning are the new emerging technological threats, things from biotech, from AI, that we're actually bringing to the world ourselves and which are going to get worse in the years to come. And that was particularly worrying, and that's what I really wanted to focus on.
Yeah, and I want to get into a couple of these, but you go down the list of potential things that could end the world, and it could be kind of depressing if you kind of focus on it a little bit. I mean, you've got asteroids, as you mentioned, volcanoes, climate change we've mentioned, nuclear war could happen, a nuclear accident or something like that. You've mentioned biotechnology and artificial intelligence. There's aliens out there as well. I mean, so many possible things. It could be kind of scary.
Yeah, and I totally understand that. And, you know, it is scary. I mean, when you really do contemplate the end of the world, you know, the end of the human species, it's definitely something that keeps you up at night. But what I really found as I experienced this and as I reported on it was that there are people working hard, and there are means we have at our disposal to reduce that risk. It's not just that we're destined to go extinct, destined for the world to end, but we actually have that in our, you know, in our hands to reduce that risk. And, you know, being able to experience those people, being able to spend time with them, really made me feel a lot more hopeful.
Well, make us feel a little bit more hopeful. What, give us a specific thing, because, you know, as we sit here talking today, the Amazon is on fire and climate change seems to be out of control. What kinds of things were you made to feel a little bit more comfortable about?
Well, you know, I think you mentioned asteroids at the top of this, and that's a great example of a threat that human beings found, you know, discovered, really learned how the impact that these events had on the planet in the past. And we're able to use technology, use our space program to search for asteroids that are out there, find the ones that might be at risk of impacting the Earth, and then actually not just detect them, but develop means to deflect them if we ever had to. You know, that's actually something we potentially could do, and that's pretty amazing. You know, the idea that we can take something that's coming from the cosmos that's wiped other species out, obviously the dinosaurs most notably, and protect ourselves. You know, that's the kind of thing that made me feel more hopeful, because it shows that we don't just bring risks and threats into the world, we can actually reduce them as well.
On the issue of climate change, we're in this era now where you still have a good number of people who don't believe that why it's happening, some reasons why it's happening. There's been a little bit of inaction, a lot of inaction in some places. Is that, on the flip side of that coin, one of the areas that you might be most concerned about?
Yeah, I mean, climate change is something where I think it shows the difficulty we have. I mean, climate change is happening. It's not like the other risks in that it's something that's always been, you know, it's not going to, you know, possibly happen or not happen. Climate change has been happening, will happen, will continue to happen. And I don't feel great about the politics around it, but I do feel positive about some of the technological sort of innovations we could make that could actually directly reduce that impact. I talk about carbon capture, which to me is one of the most amazing potential inventions out there that could really solve this problem. Problem is, it's not, it needs almost a Manhattan Project or an Apollo Project kind of funding behind it. We don't really have that yet, but that's really what we're going to need if we're going to defuse that particular threat.
You know, there's a back to the positive side of this. There's one of the things listed here is disease. There's a great deal of attention in your book about how we're fighting a lot of these diseases and how we're doing the gene editing now. This CRISPR technology has been in the headlines a lot lately. Is that one of the areas that you're hopeful that we'll be able to conquer some diseases, especially genetic diseases?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and that's a great example of something that's both a threat, you know, because gene editing actually can be used to make these viruses worse, sometimes for legitimate scientific reasons, sometimes potentially for terrorism, actually. But also, of course, it can help us deal with the risks that have been created by nature itself. And that challenge is really going to be there, like that dual threat challenge of knowing how to really deal with both something that can do good and something that can do ill as well. Figuring out how we can kind of get between those two, possibly those two poles, is a challenge I think we face, because it's easy enough if it's something that's just terrible, like nuclear weapons, we just shouldn't use them. But we don't want to ban these kind of technologies and advances. We want to get the most out of them while minimizing the risk.
In putting the book together, you've talked to a lot of folks who are at the front lines of some of this. Really some heroic people, aren't they?
They really are, you know, and that really gives me a lot of hope that people care about this. They're really making a difference. And they're something they actually, you know, they spend time thinking about the future of humanity. You know, they really actually care about these threats that seem really low probability. They seem almost impossible, but they're actually out there in the front lines, you know, and we're, you know, if we continue to survive, we're going to really owe them a debt of gratitude.
It's interesting because, you know, again, as we sit and conduct this interview, there's a new survey out about the number of people that are preparing for the end of the world. This used to be a thing around the turn of the century. I remember covering stories about Y2K and all of the preppers for Y2K getting all of their stuff together. The prepping world is still busy at it, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's more people doing that than ever before. I mean, you can really pick your prepping. You can get your backyard shelter. You can go luxury, get a vault in somewhere in South Dakota or Kansas. You know, if you're really up about it, you can go to New Zealand and make your own little luxury bolt hole. But my point here really is that this is not the kind of thing that's going to save us. You know, we're not going to be saved individually through prepperism. We need to really come together as a society. That's what's going to make a difference. These are threats that no one can handle on their own. It's going to take us coming together as a country, as a world, really, to really make sure that we can endure.
How big of a threat do you think the artificial intelligence part of this is? I know there have been some scientists and others in the tech world who are extremely fearful about this. I know Stephen Hawking, before he died, said that could be the one singular thing that ends the human race. Is it that significant?
It's hard to know, really, because it really depends on whether it's even possible. All these other threats, I know they're real. I know they could happen. With AI, it's going to depend on how well we can actually develop that. You know, there are some scientists who believe that artificial general intelligence is just around the corner. Others believe it might be impossible, that it might never be something that's doable. But if it is, you have to think about the fact that we're only on the top of the food chain on this planet because we're the smartest species out there. If we create something smarter than us, then we're in trouble. You know, we could end up being kind of shoved out of existence the same way we've done to so many other species on this planet.
Yeah, and I like the question about aliens as well. I know that seems kind of far out there, but we haven't seen it yet. At least I don't think we have, not officially. What kind of threat does that pose, and do you think there might be a reason why we haven't seen them yet?
I mean, there's two possibilities. One is that they don't exist, in which case that would actually be bad for us. It could mean that there's, you know, if they existed once but now they're gone, maybe that could happen to us as well. Maybe there's something in technological development that leads a civilization to destroy itself. And if they do exist and they can actually come to visit us, they would be technologically so advanced beyond us that we would have no means of resisting them. So we have to really hope that they're friendly and not hostile. And that's why a lot of scientists believe maybe we shouldn't be messaging life out there, because we don't really know who's on the other end. We probably shouldn't be sending them, you know, Google Map directions to our own planet.
Yeah, probably so. I have to ask, and I kind of mean this tongue-in-cheek, but also a little half-seriously, have you been having nightmares after getting all of this stuff ready for this book?
You know, I actually felt more despairing before this book. I mean, this book helped me understand the nature of the risks I face. They're really, we all face. They're very real. They're happening right now. But I also know a path forward. I also know the things we can do to protect ourselves. And that gives me a lot of hope. You know, that's really what makes the difference with me. It's what keeps me from, you know, keeps me able to sleep at night at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. And that might be the final thought for our interview here, as people are listening to this. Reading about it and getting all this information, learning about all of these different things, that goes that does wonders in terms of our understanding and of possibility of preventing some of this stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, I think we really have to understand them first. It's like any kind of situation, any kind of challenge, any kind of risk. And then we know, then we can begin to decide what we need to do about it, how we do it really as not just a country, but as a species.
Brian, thank you for taking some time out and being with us today. We appreciate it.
I appreciate it.
Brian Walsh, former foreign correspondent, reporter, and editor at Time Magazine, currently a writer for Bloomberg, Newsweek, Medium, and Time as well, and author of End Times, A Brief Guide to the End of the World.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, some weakness in the markets as we get back to work today. Dow futures are down 214 points. More than 0.75%. S&P futures are down nearly 0.75% as well. On the NASDAQ, futures are pointing towards some losses as well this morning, down nearly 0.5%. Now let's get the latest on agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Well, after a three-day layoff, the markets are back in action today for a four-day trading week. And again, we'll be dealing with the China-U.S. situation as both countries began imposing additional tariffs on each other's goods on Sunday, the latest escalation in that trade war. A new round of tariffs took effect with Beijing's levy of 5% on U.S. crude, marking the first time the fuel has been targeted since the two economies started their trade disagreement. And the Trump administration now collecting 15% tariffs on more than $125 billion in Chinese imports. The Chinese national media had this to say: the United States should learn how to behave like a responsible global power and stop acting as a school bully. That according to the Chinese media. So let's talk about some other more pleasant things, perhaps. Event that gets underway tomorrow, Sandwich Fair at the Sandwich, Illinois Fairgrounds. Been there for well over 100 years and one of the best county fairs you'll ever attend. Tomorrow, Max Armstrong will be on stage with our band. Thursday, I'll be on stage with our band, and look forward to having you join us on the outdoor stage at the Sandwich Fair. Oh, and by the way, when you're there, be sure to visit the new farm animal barn, because it's been constructed since the fair a year ago. And I think it's a place you should take the family and visit just a bit. Looking ahead, the University of Illinois College of Aces invites you to attend the 2019 Celebrate Food and Agriculture Day, Saturday, September 14th at the U of I, 8 to 11 a.m. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. A couple of more business stories before we leave you this morning. Parliament reconvening today for a pivotal day in British politics as lawmakers challenge Prime Minister Boris Johnson's insistence that the UK will leave the European Union on October 31st, even without a deal. Amid loud cries from protesters on the streets surrounding the House of Commons, lawmakers returned from their summer recess with a key piece of legislation on their agenda that would prevent an immediate no-deal exit. If it passes this week, Johnson's Downing Street office says he'll call for an early election. Toy maker Lego says its revenue rose 4% in the first half of 2019, but significant investments to grow its business in China and India led to a 12% drop in net profit. The privately held company reported first half revenue of $14.5 billion, while net profit dropped nearly $400 million. CEO of the company said the group is satisfied with the performance given the transformative shifts that the company has been making around the world. There's another story this morning involving reporters at a newspaper in Maryland this morning. Reporters and photographers at the Baltimore Sun are staging a byline strike withholding their names from the stories that they're doing to protest the latest contract offer from parent company Tribune Publishing. The Washington Baltimore Newspaper Guild calls the proposal devastating, says it includes provisions like eliminating jobs by outsourcing. Union officials say the byline strike is aimed at showing management what the paper might be like if reporters who deliver the news are no longer around. Two sides are set to return to the bargaining table next Monday. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk outlook for this Tuesday, September the 3rd. Construction spending leads off the reports today. Construction spending for July. Building industry analysts expect to see spending recover some of June's decline. They're forecasting a 0.5% gain over June. Vehicle sales for August come out as well today. Auto industry experts predict sales coming in at a annual rate of nearly 16.9 million vehicles, 100,000 more than the rate for July. Manufacturers will report their sales totals throughout the day. Also on the calendar today, the PMI Manufacturing Index, the ISM Manufacturing Index, a couple of Fed speakers out there as well, including Eric Rosengren on monetary policy and interest rates. Just some of the things that could move the markets on this Tuesday, September the 3rd.